And what about inflation? Is it fact or fiction? So we've had some great talks today. So,
So I see my job is mainly helping to manage the discussion. But let me introduce one theme regarding inflation that didn't come up in the earlier discussions, which is that one of the things that inflation, the initial case for inflation was often made in the terms of washing away dependence on initial conditions, right? That for a large range of pre-inflationary initial conditions, you'd get something that looks like the observed universe is the output. And so if you accept that line of argument, which we can see whether people accept that line of argument or not, that would actually make it seem more remote that you'd have quantum gravity results that would be left as an imprint in the early universe. So a lot of times people, when they discuss inflation, say, well, if inflation is true, that actually makes the problem of seeing quantum gravity effects in the Big Bang even more challenging. On the other hand, people then also argue to understand how inflation started, to make it both the initial conditions for inflation sensible or even understand the dynamics of inflation, you might have to take quantum gravity effects into account. So that's, I think, one interesting aspect of the debates that that Phil didn't emphasize in his really nice talk. Do we have any takers? Yeah, go ahead, Robert.
So I think there are two aspects. What you mentioned, there's the question of initial conditions, mm-hmm. and then the question of washout.
Mm-hmm.
So first of all, on the question of washout, it is true that if you have inflation, then the classical junk that's present at the beginning would be washed out.
Mm-hmm.
But what's happening is that transblocking scales will re-enter mm-hmm. the picture. So it's not that you are insensitive to time scale.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's good news for quantum gravity. Even mm-hmm. if there is inflation, you still can potentially test quantum gravity.
Good, excellent. Yeah, and I meant to be sort of summarizing the sort of conventional wisdom, but that's exactly right, that you're amplifying modes that could be transplanking or at least very short length scale.
Now, on the second point, the initial conditions for inflation, so that's a question that can be studied at the classical physics level. We have matter field mm-hmm. and we have gravity. So there's been work on this for a long time. I think it dates back to initial work by Richard Matheson and mm-hmm. collaborators. And that includes numerical work. And so I think it's established that in large field inflation models, the slow roll inflation trajectory is a local attractor in initial condition space.
Hmm.
So it is not a global attractor, but it is a local attractor.
Mm-hmm.
And so the question is, how big is the base of attraction?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm mentioning this because, again, there's been a very recent article that claims that inflation is absolutely not an attractor. And that paper, I think, is misleading because it does not reference the body of work that's been done in the past. It just points out particular configurations that don't give rise to inflation.
You're talking about the one by Garfinkel?
Yeah.
Mm.
That's right.
And Steinhardt and Ehlers.
That's right.
Yeah.
But they don't pick specific, I just looked at it yesterday, I think, just briefly. They, first of all, they're only one-dimensional in homogeneities. But within that, it sounded like they were trying to take sample, like, randomly from a very wide distribution of initial conditions. They're not cherry-picking.
That's not the way that I read the paper. They pick, there is one finite range axis, and then they have one little interval, which is not inflation. That's my reading.
Maybe I missed
it.
Lee, it's great to have you here in person. So,
yeah. My point is just different from you.
Okay.
Which is that you can argue about these small points of inflation back and forth, but we're missing an opportunity because if one, with the fundamental issue is the singularity there, and if there's something replaces it, where is it from? That's the important issue. And as we know, one of the places that it can go, that is the universe or pieces of it, and black holes can go into making new universes. And then we get new kinds of experimental tests, which weren't available before. Mm-hmm. If you take that as a basis, then you can build these natural selection models, and which you couldn't do before. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that the hope for us in quantum gravity is not going to be down the 1/4 that we could all down before, but to find completely new kinds of tests. Mm-hmm. Things that, in the absence of a new theory, wouldn't mean anything. Mm-hmm. But in the presence of a new theory, I quantum gravity opens the doors for new kinds of tests.
Great. Does anyone want to take that up? I mean, this is something that came up in Karen's talk as well. Thinking about singularities and what the outcome of their potential resolutions would be, but this is that it might open up a new avenue for testing. Yeah, go ahead, Ted.
I just kind of want to ask Lee to clarify. Are you, by test, do you mean checking predictions about the values and relations of the values of parameters in our universe?
Yes. For example, that there are no neutron stars greater than mass of the solar mass
over
2 is a prediction.
Sorry, greater than what mass?
So, solar mass over 2. Two solar masses.
Two solar
masses. Lee, can I just ask you about that? With what error bars when you say two solar masses?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know.
Okay.
No, it's important because there are cases which are wonderful.
I thought Matt has.
Yeah, Matt, you had your hand up earlier.
Well, we kind of moved on, so.
We can go back though if.
Psych.
Yeah.
So I think there have been many attempts to study this inflationary initial conditions problem, and the take home that I've gotten is that it is way, way more robust in every single case than you would have previously thought it was. So if I were to summarize like recent work by Will East, who's a faculty here, who's not here, if you make sub-horizon huge inhomogeneities, they just collapse into black holes and then inflation proceeds just fine. If you make really big super horizon inhomogeneities, then the places where they're too big don't inflate, and the places where they're small enough do. And then there's like the Goldilocks zone where you can really mess with stuff. And then it depends on if we're talking about large field inflation or small field inflation, and all the subtleties and details kind of come in. But I think the interesting spin on that is, you know, you can look at these scenarios, but I think the most interesting question to ask is, do any of these scenarios leave any traces that we could actually go look for and find? I think that's probably an underexplored aspect of the initial conditions question. I'm sure there's a creative enough theorist in this room to come up with a reason why there was just enough inflation for whatever A word reason or whatever, right? And in those scenarios, I think, you know, there are like interesting things. So for example, in the case where there are super big inhomogeneities that collapse into black holes during inflation, that will leave some imprint. And if there's just enough inflation, we can go look for it, et cetera, et cetera. You can ask about, what if the amplitude of fluctuations is super huge on just a little bit bigger than horizon scales, what would that predict for things like the observed quadrupole, curvature, et cetera? And people have done those studies, and the answers are really kind of counterintuitive. It's not, it's a little bit subtle. And in all cases, it's harder to find than you naively would have thought it was. That is the conclusion from like every one of these studies that I've seen or done myself, is you want to make these huge inhomogeneities and kill inflation and make something dramatic that we can go and observe, and it's always less bad than you thought it was going to be, and harder to observe than you thought it was going to be. So I don't know, my just to put a period on what Robert was saying, like my conclusion from all that is that it's really difficult. Inflation is really good at erasing stuff. Let me put it there.
So can I ask this Garfinkel, and I guess, what is this, can someone summarize this idea of this, I guess, this contrarian point of view that it's not an attractive? Someone. I mean, Ted, you said you already...
It sounds like Robert looked more closely than I did.
Well, this is it's a generativity simulation, so
yeah.
It's a generativity coming to a scalar field,
yeah.
And then it's then 1 plus 1 dimensions, I guess it's a relativity problem. You see, if you don't have the figures, then, okay, the new aspect is they use particular curvature invariants to describe whether you get close to inflation. These are sort of bio curvature invariants. And then if you look at the plot, then you see that in one plot you see a time evolution where the wild curvature remains large throughout. But if you then look what this plot corresponds to, it's a plot picked out, at least my design is picked out in a very narrow range of space. And so I completely agree with what you said. So.
In addition to the initial conditions problem, there's the question of how to describe the inflationary dynamics. And so we've had some discussion earlier about whether we can treat inflation as an effective field theory. And so I'm curious whether we want to turn to that as another aspect of questioning inflation and how to understand it as, you know, whether it's fact or fiction, how does it fit into an account that we can understand the scalar field dynamics? Yeah.
Yeah, actually, I have a question. It's really a technical question, but it might be quite relevant here. And I don't think I've ever, it's because I don't know the subject very well, so I haven't heard it discussed, but experts will probably know and tell me. Namely, cosmic variance. So the theory the standard inflationary theory we use predicts not only the mean values, but also the width of the distribution. And that's, of course, referred to a lot of times in the low angular momentum modes as a limiting factor on testing the theory. But we have this whole spectrum, and we can check whether the fluctuations are consistent with what you expect from vacuum fluctuations. And what I want to know is, A, has that check been done? And to what extent can it be checked? And B, does Robert's string gas cosmology, for example, that has a different origin of fluctuations, predict the same variance? So I think variance is something that can be tested because we can look at, you know, all the different M values for a given L value and see whether the distribution is, you know, whatever the theory predicts. So it's another prediction. Has it been tested?
Are you asking whether, for example, power spectrum on multiples of thousands or higher have been checked to be consistent with?
Yeah, not just thousands, but anywhere it can be done to any degree systematically across the whole spectrum. I would expect somebody, we should have tested to what extent it's consistent with the width of the distribution that the quantum theory of vacuum fluctuations predicts. And I've never seen that explicitly discussed, probably just because I don't know the subject very well, but I would like to hear the answer. And I'd like to know if Robert's origin of fluctuations predicts the same variance as vacuum fluctuations does.
I think both Matt and Robert.
Robert can go ahead.
Okay.
So in terms of the second, it's also a Gaussian distribution. So the variance would be the same. So that's the second part. The first part is whether the variance has been tested. Well, there's a discussion of anomalies for lower error. And that is a reflection of testing for the anomaly.
Right, but what about at higher L?
Higher L? I don't know. Since I've never heard of any, I assume it's been tested, but I don't know.
I mean, let's crack open the Planck map and make a histogram of the value of the ALMs for fixed L at different M.
Right.
And it's going to look a darn lot like a Gaussian. And then there's only a finite number of those M's. And so you're gonna see that histogram looks pretty wonky for low L. And that might be physics, or it might just be the realization we have. And then as you go to higher and higher M, where we get more and more numbers of M's in our bins in the histogram, then it's going to look more and more like a Gaussian. And that's been tested to...
It should look like a Gaussian of a particular width.
Yeah, of a particular width, right? And that particular width, or the Gaussian we measure of that particular width, is the one that is very, very consistent with lambda CDM, which is the power law initial conditions plus dark matter and baryons doing what we know. Yeah.
I'll ask you, but isn't it that the secondary effects and things like that?
Couldn't hear you, sorry.
The secondary effects, doesn't that wash out some of those signals? Or are you saying it still can, we can still measure the Gaussian?
Well, we get to high NFL and then, you know, the silk damping has killed the CMB and so we can't play that game anymore. And then you're right, and now we're measuring lensing and CMB photons bouncing off of electrons, and those don't have a Gaussian distribution, so then that will, that those tests will not work anymore. We're testing something different, right? But I think to the precision we can use 1,000, you know, M's, which is roughly where, you know, the CMB is going to cut out at L of 2,000 or so, and then the number of M's we have is double that. You know, it's really guessing, and that's definitely been measured and tested.
Could I raise two other questions that came up in the discussions today that might be interesting topics for the discussion? One is, do we think of singularity resolution as a criteria for a successful theory of quantum gravity? And if so, what do we mean by singularity resolution? What would be a successful answer to the question of the problem of singularities, if it's a problem, or maybe there's an array of attitudes that are displayed, as Karen described? And then the other question is about the question of a final theory and whether we should think of a proposed quantum gravity theory as a final theory in the way that Ricard was looking at it, or how different people who work on quantum gravity feel about the possibility of a final theory in the way that Ricard was describing it. So I don't know if anybody wants to take up those, but those are two other really interesting things that came up. Yeah, go ahead, Lee.
I think strongly that we're not looking for a final theory. We're looking for a mechanism that accounts for things. Just like Darwin is not looking for a final distribution of species, he's looking for a mechanism that accounts species.
Hmm.
I think we until we turn that corner, we're going to be wasting our time.
Okay, Carlo?
Maybe I was influenced by my history education. I went to school at the university at the time in which the strong interactions were not figured out yet. And everybody was at the time, that was a dogma of the day, that to put order in the strong interactions in the hadron zoology meant for sure resolving understanding what's the normalization theory, getting rid of all the infinities. And so on, there were all the time the bootstrap, the serial, that stuff. And so, since there were two problems, for sure the problems had to be answered together. And that turned out completely wrong. I mean, everything I was told at school was completely wrong. Because QCD came out, and nobody believed in quantum field theory anymore. But QCD, a few people QCD came out, it was a spectacular success, and just washed away completely this idea that. Figure out the strong interactions could only be done after having rolled together all the problem. And so, but my attitude, I just present this, my attitude to quantum gravity is that the idea that quantum gravity could be connected to the problem of unification with the other, it's an interesting idea, and I respect people that that go this way, but I don't bet on it at all. And I think it's much more likely, it seems much more likely to me that there's a very well clear problem, seems to me, which is we don't know how the gravitational field behaves when there are quantum phenomena involved. We know regions of the universe where this happens.
Mm-hmm.
We expect this to happen. So this is a precise, very well defined problem. How does gravity behave quantum mechanically? It's a big problem, it's a huge problem, it's nothing to do with unification with the other. I don't see the reason, I mean, I see, I see the arguments which are presented, mm-hmm. but I don't find them compelling. So I find it is better, for myself, I find a far more promising strategy to just try to solve that problem and mm-hmm. not the final theory, the unification or anything like that, which are great, but we have to leave things for our grandchildren.
Ricard, yeah.
So as I view it, the question is not that much whether one would aim at finding a final theory. I mean, I would agree that may not be the most pressing goal one wants to have in physics, and it may be, let's say, misleading or misdirecting research if one aimed at that. I would rather view the situation differently. I would ask the question whether I think there is a pretty strong attitude in physics that has emerged in the context of rejecting previous final theory claims that is highly skeptical of indications of finality, let's say. So what I would rather think is that the question is whether one wants to be sensitive to indications one gets from some theories that this theory may be fine. Obviously, now is not the time to decide that or to be awfully confident about a finality of a theory. But the question I want to raise is whether one is not overly dogmatic in the other side. To get in the other direction, let's say, whether one just doesn't want to consider indications that may indicate that may point towards finality, that may narrow down the perspective on what is going on.
Do you agree that belief in the final theory, even knowing what you mean by a final theory, depends strongly on the induction of time? That is, somebody who is willing to assert that X is a final theory has a notion in which time ultimately traps happiness. And so I have a very, personally, I have a completely opposite notion of time. I have a notion which time is the only fundamental thing in physics. Therefore, I don't even understand, in the context of my thought, what you might mean, my final theory. I mean no disrespect with that. I mean even if you're on the other side of the line, as far as your views of time are.
I'm not sure whether I fully understand.
So why
is your point that finality with respect to, let's say, the human enterprise of finality theory would need to be aligned with the physical concept of time and time?
Yes, because if you believe that everything changes, and then change changes.
Mm.
If I can put it that way, there's no notion of a final theory that can make any sense.
And if we reach the finality, then there's no time left as well.
Yes, but I think we.
Yes, go ahead.
I was going to say my understanding of the rationale behind looking for a final theory is the history of physics going back hundreds of years to Newton, when the celestial and terrestrial were united in a particular theory. And there is an argument saying, in some sense, this is the job of physics to find connections between apparently disparate phenomena in a theoretical framework that encompasses them with a greater measure of simplicity and explanatory power. Now, you might say, okay, we're too obsessed with that, but it would be a departure, I think, from what physics generally is being. Now, many physicists, there's all kinds of physics, we focus on subsystems, subsets, to learn more about them, but that's a very different statement or approach from saying we shouldn't do it at all, that we should give up the search.
Yeah, go ahead, Francesca.
Can I react to this?
Sure.
So I would like to make a distinction between a unification and consistency. So one thing is a very specific program in which you want to figure out a unique symmetry group from which everything emerged. Another project is more humble, is to have a language that is transversal and can be used to describe battlefields as well as the gravitational fields. And I think it's possible within quantum gravity. So for instance, when we do loop quantum gravity, basically what we are doing is a discretized version of a quantum field theory on a lattice. So, I mean, so we are, it's true that we don't do unification, but we are making generativity, or actually the gravitational theory, consistent with all the other things that we know. So, I mean, I would be careful about how we use these different concepts and we discuss them as if they were the same.
Well, yeah, I mean,
because for Newton or for Einstein, I would say that there was also this consistency component.
Yeah, there. Well, I mean, I think that's part of finality and unification, is attaining consistency and clarity of phenomenon. I mean, I've been told, I've never checked this, but I've been told if you value computational efficiency, then we should all go back to the Ptolemaic theory of the planets, because I've been told that you put in all the epicycles for the solar system, it computes the motion of the planets faster and more efficiently than the Newtonian paradigm. Of course, we don't believe in the Ptolemaic model because its explanatory power is El Stinko. But nevertheless, if you had a different criterion, assuming what I've been told is correct, you would think differently about it, that's all. I mean, I'm fully sympathetic, Francesca, to the notion that we need to just not look necessarily at symmetry groups. But even empirically, like in our lifetimes, we found, might get shot for this, all the basic subatomic particles. When I was a kid, we didn't know what half of these things were. And we furthermore have very good evidence that if there is a fourth generation or anything above the so-called standard model particle physics, they look way, way, way different than any of the rest. It could have been different. There could have been like 200,000 different subatomic particles. There was no guarantee a priori that that's true. In fact, when I teach particle, I say it'd be a lot harder to teach this course if there were 10 to the 80 different kinds of subatomic particles. Think of the homework, right? So I'm just saying that we may want to depart from seeking the so-called final theory, but it would be a departure from, in some sense, what the goal of physics always has been.
I'd like, Sorry, I'd just like to ask for some of the younger people here to raise your voices, ask questions about the talks. We've had a lot of you haven't been actively participating. I think we have some questions that some of us have generated on the board, but I'm sure all of you have other questions that you'd like to discuss as well. So I'd like to make sure we have some broader participation. So I don't know everyone's name, so I can't really do the Socratic system and just start calling on people, but there are a few of you whose names I know.
All in my coordinates.
Do you have a space time? Yes.
Can you guys hear me?
Yes.
I'm online. I'm also a young person. So I want to thank that professor from Sweden who gave the talk on the singularities, because I didn't know that there was people who had the same attitude of having singularities being fine in the theory. So I do want to focus on that a little bit, because I honestly don't know why we even want to get rid of singularities in GR and they can't just be a prediction of the theory. I truly don't know why people look for space and time to be emergent concepts. They don't seem very natural to me. And so maybe that's because I haven't read enough literature and I'm stuck on the idea when Rehler said that space-time is the arena. And I push that analogy a little bit further. If I view quantum information as the gladiators, why am I asking them to understand the holes underneath of them? And so hopefully that made sense. And I truly don't understand why some people think it's natural to kind of just give up space-time. So there we go.
Okay, so there's two different lines of questioning there. One is, should we just love singularities, as Mahesh put it? And the other is, why should we think of space-time as an emergent notion from something else that's non-spatiotemporal? So I don't know if anybody wants to take up either of those. So Lee, you have a...
you know, I will defend taking space as emergent. It's time, I don't think it's emergent. Space is emergent, I think, because if we left space as a fundamental entity, there's a long list of things that we would never have hope of explaining. And things include part of the special particle of the standard model. Exactly how gravity works. So this is a long discussion, but the reason why I believe that space is emergent is I think that in theory it doesn't. It starts with space having its fundamental properties. It isn't sufficiently explanatory.
Do you think time is unique? Do
you think time is unique?
Everybody agrees.
Not everyone can hear.
Is time unique? That was the question. If time is not emergent, but space is, then?
I think in that sense, time is unique. Time is very different from space.
No, what I mean is, like, do I have, like, something like Leighton was saying yesterday, I have two universes, one has a time in different direction than the other.
No. Okay, Carlo?
I would like to respond to the young person that came from the
internet.
Yes.
The spirit of old.
Yeah.
Because I thought of the question, and presented this way, the question makes sense. And if I imagine a young student just coming out from high school and listening to a discussion like that, there are a lot of things that seem to be falling from the sky. I mean, we don't want singularities. We don't want space-time as we want a super fast phase of expansion, super rapid at the beginning of the universe. All these things which are taken as meaningful and sources of ideas and theories, just they don't make sense by themselves, all of them.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess what I'm trying to say is that. The only way to enter into discussion is to follow the full discussion. There was a problem, definitely. There was a long discussion about this problem. There are a certain number of attitudes that have come out that don't come out as, I mean, it's very nice to see the list of the attitudes. We dislike singularity, we like singularity. But these are not a priori attitude. These are results of a long path of papers, counter-papers, argument, discussions, and many of us changed mind a few times and got to convinced something, probably wrong, maybe wrongly, I don't say. But I don't think there's a shortcut. Maybe I'm feeling an old guy who's preaching to the young kids, I'm sorry. But there's no shortcut. It's sitting down and studying decades of theoretical work. And that's how you get to understanding the discussion of the frontier. I don't think that the discussion by itself makes any sense unless one goes through the full previous discussion. So it's an invitation to study all the way back to Bronstein, Wheeler, Feinberg, and everybody, all the way to now, Witten and company, all the discussions. Because that's the otherwise, one keep repeating the same stories over and over again and get back to simplicity attitudes, seems to me.
Yes.
Well, I just, are you still online?
The young person.
I'm still listening.
Oh, you are?
Yeah, I'm still listening.
I just want to check that consciousness was still present. So, yeah, I mean, but another way, I would just say, I'm going to turn around, and notwithstanding what Carlo said, I agree with, on the one hand, it is part of a larger discussion, but I would say the soundbite answer is that there are many implications from physics that say at short distances things seem to break down at very high energies at the center of a black hole. So this leads a number of people to think that perhaps the cure for this is discretizing or modifying the structure of space or space-time itself. And then there is a whole historical context to that, but if you were a kid in my class asking for an answer, that's what I would say.
So you're saying, and I guess Carlo too, so you're not motivated by
the desire to resolve these particular singularities in GR at all. You're more focused on these other motivations, the external motivations, I call them, for thinking that space-time is going to break down anyway. So singularities aren't a motivation at all?
Well, I think they are in the sense that when you have them, you get answers that don't make sense. Then the question is, do you want answers that make sense? And if they do and singularities are there, that's fine. Or are the singularities genuinely evil and their expulsion will cure our problems? Personally, I'm agnostic. I lean a little bit towards singularities are evil. But basically, because my understanding of them in space-time is there's no space and time where a singularity is. So how do you write down physics? How do you write down any equations that describe physics? And maybe somebody in this room will say, oh, Rob, I can do it this way. And maybe they can. But that would be, that would be the rationale. Like, I'm trying to summarize for someone who comes in and doesn't get it, to give them a soundbite answer as a place to start. I'm fully aware there is a much deeper discussion, and I don't want to negate that, but I do remember as a grad student picking grad school, seeing profs, and a prof put down here's what I'm doing, isn't this great, and gave me a stack of papers this high. And I thought I'm supposed to read that. So you've got to start somewhere, that's all.
Go ahead, Claude.
I mean, it goes back to the philosophy of physics itself. Why do we do physics? We like to describe nature or the phenomenon through some mathematics, and if we reach some state where our tools are breaking down, so we like to describe it, and singularities are those places, and so GR tools are breaking, so that's why, I mean, you can call it love or evil, it's just that we need to deal with it, if we are physicists.
Maybe
you're not evil. So, Francesca, you had
So the discussion has shifted more towards singularities, but the question was also addressing another point that was that of emergence. And I think, I feel I'm going to repeat the same position that I had with respect to unification versus consistency, in the sense that when we talk about emergence, there is not just a possibility in which we have on one hand space-time and on the other hand we have something that is completely different that we don't know. And there is also a possibility in the between that, by the way, this is what we do in loop quantum gravity, that is that, yes, you take all the properties that space and time have at a classical level, and some of these properties disappear at the quantum level, but there are many of the properties that we attribute to space and time, like the change nature, so there is change even if there is a single variable that represents time, or we can have the Lorentz symmetry, or we can have adjacency relations. So if you make a list of all the properties for space and time, maybe there is one or two that you give up, continuity, but all the others are still there. So it's not that from classical space-time we jump to directly to something that is completely creative, I don't know, unknown. So of course there is a possibility there is something even deeper there, but we can go step by step in doing quantum gravity.
Okay, so I'm looking for, oh yeah, go ahead, Nash.
I just was going to say, I do wonder whether, I mean, this is obviously a great question, but I wonder if, just going back to the question of Big Bang, what I do wonder about, I wonder if you have any opinion about it, is that, I mean, do we need quantum gravity to understand Big Bang, one, and the second is, will we ever make progress, notwithstanding what Phil said today, will we ever make progress in either testing inflation or ruling out inflation? Because no matter what observations have given us over the past 20 years, there have been inflation models that explain them. Remember when there was curvature that was favored and there were inflation models that explained them. There were biceps, there were inflation models that explained them. So observations kept changing over time, but inflation was always right on target. So somehow it's an unclearable model, and is that a fair criticism?
So I think there's two questions there. One is,
It would be interesting to get a historical perspective, because in the 90s, when omega was thought to be 0.3, interviews I've done was that that was a very uncomfortable time for inflationary cosmologists. So if anyone was around in the 90s, it would be good to hear if that was the impression. Robert, you were. So do you want to comment on that?
So my view is that inflation was invented to solve fine-tuning problems in cosmology. And if we replace them by fine-tuning problems in the scalar field model, then we haven't made progress. And so if you could ask Slava Mukhanov, one of the key contributors to inflation, he would say if the simplest model of inflation doesn't work, then he would give up on inflation. And I know that he will act on that. I've seen him act on that. So I'm optimistic saying that the observations will give us guidance. I don't know what we will learn, but I'm optimistic that we will learn a lot from observations.
I mean, even I am old enough to remember this. I remember maybe in this very room, Lenny Susskind was giving a talk about how you expect a minimum amount of refoldings based on landscape models, and we are actually seeing a signature of that in the CME right now, and universe is going to have negative curvature because if you have minimal amount of refolding and because you have one of the creations have negative curvature. So that was around the time, that was a little bit after the 90s, it was 2006 or 2007. But the point is, I mean, there was a justification at the time, and everybody said it's very natural to have very few e-foldings of inflation. That's what all the landscape models can tell you, and that's how people justify the curvature. Had it been seen, but of course now it's not seen, and that's a non-issue. But I'm just worried that whatever observations give us, there will be someone who will argue that this is exactly what we expected.
Well, concerning the question, do we need quantum gravity at the Big Bang, I think that depends on whether or not gravity really is quantum. And we don't know for sure if it is. It may be that everything is quantum except gravity. And that is, if you go to quantum optics people, they're very open to that kind of idea. If you go to particle people, then you're lucky to escape with your life. But it is the question, and clearly, I mean, these experiments, tabletop experiments about gravitational entanglement and so on, if they can be done, and if their interpretation is what people say they are, and there's controversy over that, but nevertheless, if there is evidence, let's say, in the next 10 years, that gravity does not entangle, that's going to radically change the picture, and right back to the Big Bang. And we'll have to somehow come to terms with a reality in which gravity doesn't want to be quantized and everything else does. And I know all the hybrid problems and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, this is what will happen if this is what comes out.
So what do people take as the best reasons for the necessity of quantizing gravity? I take it you're challenging, you know, is it the case that we actually need to quantize gravity? And if we had the negative results of these tabletop...
Well, I'm agnostic on it personally, but I think more attention needs to be given to gravity not entangling in terms of theoretical brain power than perhaps has been the case in the past. That's all. But there are standard arguments as to why it should be. I mean, primarily because hybrid classical quantum models generally fall apart or don't work very well, and then there are arguments about if you don't quantize the stress energy, then you get inconsistencies in Einstein equations, all this stuff, right? I mean, that's sure, but...
Yeah, Carlo.
I agree that if those experiments can be done, and if the result is that there's not become credible, there's no entanglement due to gravity, I think that would be a fantastic discovery that changes completely what we expect, what we think. But that's true for all experiment that tests something that we expect. And it might happen. I mean, we've been testing violation of quantum mechanics for 50 years, and each time if quantum mechanics had come up wrong, it would have been fantastic and super interesting. A lot of effort has been in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s put into trying to see if there is a consistent theory of quantum matters and classical gravity. I remember that. There's a large literature on that, and I think that the strongest argument for quantum gravity, for gravity being quantum, in my opinion, is that we do have incomplete theories of quantum gravity, and we do not have any strong theoretical arguments indicating that definitely so the gravitational field is different than the electromagnetic field, so one is quantized, the other isn't. On the other hand, and that's my point, we do not have any theory that stays together decently and has a dynamics, and we do not have anything except absolutely vague wave handling models which could give a decent picture that include what we know about the world, so include generativity, include the quantum mechanics, quantum theory, the gravity not quantized. There seems to be that the theoretical evidence is not definitive because we need check, that's what it's about, but the theoretical evidence is overwhelming for betting. In other words, if I had my money to bet, I would bet, in fact, I have bet.
What do you mean by theoretical evidence?
The lack of decades of people trying to put together a decent theory of quantum matter and failing. So not evidence in the sense of mathematical proof, but I think it cuts. I mean, we've failed to construct a quantum theory of matter with classical gravity.
We've also failed to construct a quantum theory of gravity. So, I mean, it's even Stephen in that regard.
No, we failed to have an agreement. Because this is completely different. We failed to have agreement on a theory. But we have a number, at least two or three or four, we've mentioned here, of possible theory of quantum gravity. They might be wrong. Each one of them might be wrong. Each one of them might be incomplete. But we don't have any stronger arguments that this could not be completed.
There is one argument, which is one can take the experimental tests of quantum electrodynamics, like the existence of an algorithm for photons. Action, because otherwise we would have an ultraviolet catastrophe and other such arguments. And you can show one by one that they can apply to the gravitational field.
Sorry, why could one by one
they cannot be applied to the gravitational field. That is, if the gravitational field has an ultraviolet catastrophe, it will never be realized because one can't construct an equilibrium for the box or container. The gravitational waves will continue long enough to see the ultraviolet catastrophe. So there's a list of simple Gordon arguments that we might have been able to make for quantum gravity that we cannot make. I don't know what to make of that, but I think it's important.
Well, I'd also point out that we have we have empirical evidence that quantum knows about gravity. We have the COW experiments that neutrons diffract in a gravitational field, and we have the Nesbyshevsky experiments that neutrons will achieve in the constant gravitational field the quantized energy levels as given by the zeros of the Airy function. And so that's an important piece of data, that quantum physics thinks gravity is a potential like any other. Quantum mechanics does anyway. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean gravity is quantized, but it does mean they at least talk to each other a little bit. And the other, I think, actually, is the existence of gravity waves. I mean, here I guess you'd go back and forth, but it would be the first field wave that isn't quantized if gravity is not.
But it travels at the speed of light.
Yeah. Doesn't everything? But it does travel. So yeah, I agree. What? So what? I mean.
So we think that photons are quantized. The dual particle wave. So we take photons as quantized.
But why does it matter if it's light speed? Things are quantized that don't travel at the speed of light, like electrons. So I don't know why it matters if it goes at the speed of light, though I agree that's an important piece of information for other reasons. But they do resemble each other in every other way. I would agree with that. Graviton, gravity waves, photon waves that are apart from the spin 2 polarization versus spin 1, yeah.
It doesn't bother me that you can't make the thermal distribution of gravitons.
It doesn't bother me.
That there's no thermal distribution of gravitons.
Bother me at all. I mean, that happened to be a configuration that led us to discover quantum mechanics.
Right.
But so what if gravitons don't go in that configuration?
Well, I agree. It's not definitive, but...
I mean, it's not the only argument for quantum mechanics. If it were the only one, that would be important.
So we only have 5 minutes. And I do wonder whether we can hear from people under 30, or I don't know, I don't want to be an atheist. And I know that about 35, I don't know.
Okay, if nobody's going to say anything.
But do I hear 50?
I mean, since this is a philosophy and physics meeting, I get to say something about real numbers and the idea of a continuum, which, you know, I mean, even as a physicist and certainly on my philosophical musings, seems like a totally artificial human construction, which surely can't be part of the fundamental, you know, laws of nature, ultimately. So if it's not, then it just shows ab initio that what we think of as space and time now, which are continua, you know, are not fundamental.
So you're saying real numbers that cannot be possibly real.
Right.
Thank you.
Yeah. They're sure convenient, though, but yeah.
Yeah.
See me again?
Okay.
That's mathematically inconsistent, right? It's a mathematical statement. We know what the reals are.
Can you guys hear me?
Yep.
Yes.
So someone brought up gravitational waves, and I actually would like to make a comment on that because I'm not sure if the question is even being asked because super radiance has kind of taken over most of the talk when it comes to like frame dragging and stuff. So would we expect quantum gravity to be able to talk about, say, quantum fields and ergospheres when we have those neutron star black hole mergers, right? Would that be a case where we would have like an actual way to test quantum gravity, or would that just be a case of curved space-time with quantum fields?
Nyesh, have you thought about it? I mean, you've looked at like echoes from.
I think the question is asking without the horizons. I think it's quantum fields in curved space time. And if you do add the horizons, then it becomes more complicated. And Samir probably would talk much more about that.
I would say that this kind of view is that no, that's just quantum field curved space time. And that. I would still characterize the standard view as that maybe less, that also on an horizon, one would expect just quantum theory of closed space time, but there is a larger discussion because some people disagree with it.
The last chance to get your opinion about Big Bang known?
Well, let me just go back because Ted raised an interesting point. So, where do you? If you take this seriously, and it's, many people have raised this at various times, it really undermines a lot of, or most of what we do, right?
No.
I mean,
no.
What? No. Okay, we've got lots of no's, so slowly through here.
Sorry, Steve, what undermines what?
Yeah,
the fact that real numbers aren't real, I think, undermines.
It's a very good approximation to different equations. Difference
equations. Right, but we don't work with difference equations, and we have lots of assumptions about continuity and smoothness and whatnot built in throughout our theoretical superstructure. That's what I'm pointing at. And at some point, maybe those are. I mean, this came up in the development of chaos theory, as I recall, right? People did a lot of numerical simulations and found things like strange attractors, and then the question was raised, how do we know that those aren't artifacts of the discretization, of the approximation that we're doing to do numerical work? And that took a lot of real mathematical work, and I don't actually know how it was resolved, but I take it that more definitive answers were eventually on offer. But we haven't done a ton of that in physics that I know of, and that's just the question I'm raising.
But I think we do that all the
time. It might have real consequences.
Don't we do that every time we do numerical analysis, though? I mean, we don't have computers using real numbers, right? They're always using.
Right. Well, we used to, but back in the old days, Chris, analog computers.
Well, yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, I mean, but it's something that comes up, and what you have to ask, what are the consequences of? I take it that's why Ted raised it.
Robert.
Yes, yeah, so I'd like to come back to what Nash said. I'm not also to the fact that apparently the people who are less than 30 are not speaking up. So
yeah.
I would give you a homework problem. I remember the conference, and so this is now also related to what he said here about how would we ever know if inflation is right or wrong. I remember the meeting, Andre Linde was sort of defending inflation. And he ended up sort of saying that it is so beautiful, it has to be right.
Yeah.
So now the challenge is, you have to invent something which is more beautiful. If you come up with something that's more beautiful and agrees with observations, then you are losers. So this is your homework problem.
Have fun till tomorrow. End of the day.
It's good Friday afternoon.
And then you present it.
Right. Robert's going to grade them.
I have a comment about Ted, real numbers not real, and which goes back and forth. First, I think a priori argument like that, I'm not convinced, but I'm convinced about the thesis. I would agree with Ted that I wouldn't expect real numbers to be an essential describing nature. In fact, I would expect the opposite. And I want to make a point about the fact that these discussions are not empty and useless in physics by making a historical remark, which I just discovered recently, which is that Max Born was convinced that we had to replace derivatives with difference equations. And this is a reason in Göttingen they were using the kind of mathematics they were using. And that's a reason Heisenberg was using the kind of mathematics he was using when he did the Mastership 25 paper in Helgoland, which is the beginning of quantum theory. So good or bad, the argument, the Max Born conviction that continuity, he was convinced that quantum theory should be completely discrete, fully discrete, nothing continuous. Later on, they sort of back. But that sort of provision is at the beginning. It's at the origin of the breakthrough of Heisenberg and matrix mechanics. So this kind of speculations are sometimes so unproductive. I think that's funny.
Yes.
Something related to Robert Cohen, which I wonder about as well, because like when we put the final theory, unification, consistency, I don't see like a beautiful, because I can think of like maybe we come up with two different consistent theories that describe at the same level the physics, and then do we have to decide the one, or, I mean, it again plays into the, let's say, alternatives of theories about inflation, then like, and what other tools do we have to choose, or do we have to choose? Right? One is better.
Yeah. Okay, go ahead, Frantz.
No, I was saying it's a classical question in philosophy of science, right?
Well, I mean, I really think this is, to borrow a line from Einstein, questions of elegance are best left to the tailor. partly because I don't think the questions of simplicity and elegance are something that are independently derived. They're based on your background, your training. And so it really reflects your own training, what you find as an elegant solution to a problem. So I think there's other ways of asking the question, though, about, you know, what other criteria of theory choice could you have? And what you really want to ask is, are any of those criteria actually good guides to what would most likely be a true theory? And I just don't think simplicity and elegance are really that. They're a good guide for other things, which is maybe your ability to compute with them. If you have a simpler theory, you can learn how it works more quickly. You might be able to see its consequences more quickly, but that doesn't necessarily correlate with its truth. So,
but if I can add to what you're saying, you don't have to choose. I mean, we are not obliged to choose. And what happens, in fact, is that you keep on being opportunistic. You may sometimes not even believe the theory you're using. Think about Planck. Planck himself, he was postulating discreteness just out of convenience for computational reasons. And then with time, people keep on using different tools, and the tools establish themselves because they are more useful, because they open up the doors to other new theories. So then you have new theories that cannot do without the conceptual framework that was decided before. So I think that this is not really a question. We don't have to answer this question. We can just keep on working, and then there will be somehow a natural selection by what is more successful.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, everyone. I think we'll try to do better in the future panel discussions at getting everybody's name, for those of you under 30, so that we will call on you.
Yes, we're going to have an under 30 list.
Yes.
So tomorrow we're going to meet at 9 a.m. Samia.
Thank you, everyone.